Good morning, this is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the May 8th, 2013 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Last month, on April 15th, Israeli Jews and their supporters around the world celebrated Israel's Independence Day, commemorating the moment when 65 years ago, on May 15th, by the Western calendar, Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, declared Israel statehood, an event that the Palestinians remember as their Nakba, or catastrophe, since it set in motion the ethnic cleansing from their homeland of 750,000 Palestinians and the destruction of nearly 500 of their towns and villages by the new state's army and allied militia groups. In retrospect, it set in stone their respective positions today, one the Israelis, the occupier, the other the Palestinians, the occupied. And furthermore, it laid the groundwork for almost every conflict that has taken place in the Middle East since the end of World War II, including the bloodletting taking place in Syria today. Despite all the talk about the so-called peace process, the truth today is that the situation of the occupied and oppressed Palestinians is worse than it has ever been, and it is worsening as Israel continues its defiance of international law and gobbles up more and more Palestinian land and water resources. Those are the words of veteran British journalist and former BBC and ITV radio host Alan Hart, who has been covering the region and writing and reporting about the Israel-Palestine conflict since the 1967 war, and with whom I will be speaking, I hope, in about 20 minutes past the hour, and we also hope to get his comments on what is happening in Syria, so stay tuned for that. As if the tragedy unfolding in Syria was not already bad enough, some might say beyond comprehension, Israel decided to enter and escalate the conflict. This past Friday and Sunday, its military launched major attacks against Syrian government military installations and warehouses in Damascus, killing over 100 Syrian soldiers on the pretext, according to the U.S. officials who justified the Israeli airstrikes, of preventing Syria from shipping missiles to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Neither Israeli officials, who will not comment themselves on the raid, nor their U.S. puppets have offered any evidence that such a transfer of heavy weapons to a Syria's Lebanese ally was taking place, and the U.S. media has repeated these allegations without demanding any. But these aren't just any puppets, mind you. First up on the stage was President Obama, who said after Friday's airstrike that Israel has a right to do whatever the Netanyahu regime believes is necessary to defend itself, and similar words were echoed by his press spokesman, Jay Carney, on Monday. Then it was Obama's newly minted defense secretary, Chuck Hagel's turn. Hagel, who learned from his humiliating confirmation hearing that publicly challenging Israel in Washington will not be tolerated, announced that the U.S. is also considering airstrikes against the Syrians, and he is expected to amplify that when he speaks tomorrow night to the annual conference of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, or WINEP, at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in our nation's capital. WINEP, currently the nation's leading Middle East think tank, was launched by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, in 1985 for situations such as this, as you will never see or hear any reference to its pro-Israel origins from any of the mainstream media hosts who routinely seek expert, quote-unquote, independent, quote-unquote, commentary from WINEP's assemblage of talking heads. Now listen closely, because here's where it gets interesting. Before Hagel takes the mic, in an off-the-record session beginning at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, that means no media, those privileged to attend the WINEP conference will hear from Colonel Abdul Hamid Zakaria, commander and spokesman for the Free Syrian Army, and Colonel Abdul Jabbar Akhidi, Free Syrian Army commander and head of the Revolutionary Military Council in Aleppo. They will participate in what the conference schedule describes as, quote, a breakout discussion entitled, quote, Inside Syria, the Battle Against Assad's Regime, end quote. What other conclusion can be drawn from this event, which I guarantee you will not be publicized anywhere else, than that the Syrian opposition is in bed with the Israel lobby, which has been leading the way in pressuring President Obama to intervene militarily in Syria? It should be recalled that very early in the Syrian uprising, as I reported at the time, the Washington Institute embraced the so-called Syrian National Coalition and launched an online blog called the Fikra Forum, which was designed to draw Arab intellectuals into the pro-Israel orbit. It seems to have exceeded probably beyond WinEP's wildest expectations. When clicking on the About Us button on Fikra, one reads that the Fikra Forum is a, quote, an online community that aims to generate ideas to support Arab Democrats in their struggle with authoritarians and extremists. It goes on. At a time of dramatic change across the region, Fikra Forum is the first near real-time, fully translated Arabic-English blog to provide a two-way platform for those in the region seeking to shape the future of their countries and U.S.-based decision-makers and opinion leaders who are trying to understand and support those efforts, end quote. There is no mention that the website is a project of the Washington Institute, in other words, AIPAC. One has to go to WinEP's website to learn that. On April 17th, Hagel and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, testified to the Senate Armed Services Committee that President Obama had not asked for military options in Syria, with Dempsey adding that he had rethought his recommendation last year to arm the Syrian rebels because he was no longer sure he, quote, could clearly identify the right people, end quote, within the opposition to supply arms. The apparent U.S. turnaround follows the Israeli attack, which reportedly has been in the works since Obama's visit to Israel last month, and follows claims by Great Britain, France, and Israel, as well as U.S. intelligence agencies, that the Syrian regime has used sarin gas in a small scale, although, quote, the chain of custody is not clear, end quote, but the compliant mainstream media is treating it as a fact. Not only is it not clear, the trail leads in another direction toward the so-called rebels who are doing everything they can to induce outside intervention by the U.S. and its NATO allies. The U.N. Commission of Inquiry, however, has seen no evidence of government forces having used chemical weapons, according to respected commission member Carla Del Ponte. Said Del Ponte on Swiss-Italian television, quote, our investigators have been in neighboring countries interviewing victims, doctors, and field hospitals, and according to their report of last week, which I have seen, she says, there are strong concrete suspicions but not yet incontrovertible proof of the use of sarin gas from the way the victims were treated. This was used, she says, on the part of the opposition, the rebels, not by the government authorities. Carla Ponte, a former Swiss attorney general, served as the prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which is why you probably heard her name. For his part, Syrian President Bashar Assad reportedly warned on Monday that any further Israeli action on Syrian territory would necessitate, quote, a declaration of war, unquote. The Kuwaiti newspaper Arai reported that Assad sent a letter to Washington through Moscow indicating that any further military action on the part of Israel would evoke an immediate response. It said Assad expected an answer from U.S. officials within 24 hours. Then Sunday, Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen TV, considered close to the regime of President Assad, quoted a Syrian official as saying that the country had stationed missile batteries aimed at Israel in the aftermath of the Israeli airstrikes. I've yet to see either story reported in the U.S. media. U.S., Israeli, and other Western officials have expressed doubts that Syria would take on what is considered to be the sixth most powerful military in the world, as was evident when the Israelis bombed what was said to be Syria's nuclear reactor in 2007, and Assad did not respond. But these are different days, however, and with much more to lose on the line and perhaps something to gain, a Syrian military response to a subsequent Israeli attack is not out of the question. Should Assad have its forces answer the next Israeli attack with missiles of its own targeting Israel, whatever the result, it would elevate Assad's standing in the Arab world, which has taken a beating because of the brutal response he and his military forces have made to the two-year-old uprising. But then we would have another Middle East war of conceivably far more disastrous consequences than anything we have seen thus far. Ehud Yari, what the New York Times describes as an Arab affairs analyst for Israel's Channel 2 News, and what do you know, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, he said Sunday that all the Israeli targets in Damascus were, quote unquote, Hezbollah controlled, end quote, which even the Times had to question by pointing out that the soldiers killed there were Syrian. His statement, however, is in keeping with Israel's obsession over the Lebanese resistance organization, which humiliated Israel's vaunted military in their 34-day war in 2006 after forcing an end to Israel's 18-year occupation of Lebanon in 2000. According to Monday's Times, quote, determined not to repeat those mistakes, the Israeli army has been preparing for what it sees as an inevitable next round in Lebanon, including a huge surprise drill last week in which 2,000 reservists were summoned to Israel's north, end quote. And what has been the reaction from Congress to the Israeli attack, apart from Senator John Mad Dog McCain, who has yet to see an opportunity for U.S. military action that he doesn't support? Well, speaking on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, Vermont's liberal senator Patrick Leahy, at one time a lukewarm critic of Israeli belligerency, could only offer that, quote, the Russian-supplied air defense systems in Syria are not as good as said, end quote. Leahy noted that Israel was using American-made F-16 jets to launch the missiles against Syrian targets. Keep in mind, he said, the Israelis are using weapons supplied by us. They have enormous prowess with those weapons, end quote. I think some people around the world have long been keeping in mind the source of Israel's prowess with its weaponry, and the bombing of the Boston Marathon may have reflected that. That was also the opinion of former Takes on the World guest Bill Blum in his monthly anti-empire report. Said Blum, quote, what is it that makes young men, reasonably well-educated, in good health, and nice-looking, with long lives ahead of them, use powerful explosives to murder complete strangers because of political beliefs? I'm speaking about American military personnel, of course, he says, on the ground, in the air, or directing drones from an office in Nevada. Do not the survivors of U.S. attacks in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, Libya, and elsewhere, and their loved ones ask such a question? The survivors and loved ones in Boston have their answer, America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's what Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the surviving Boston bomber, has said in custody, writes Blum, and there's no reason to doubt that he means it, nor the dozens of others in the past two decades who have carried out terrorist attacks against American targets and expressed anger toward U.S. foreign policy. Both Tsarnaev brothers had expressed such opinions before the attack as well. The Marathon bombing took place just days after a deadly U.S. attack in Afghanistan killed 17 civilians, including 12 children, as but one example of countless similar horrors from recent years, Blum points out. Oh, an American says, but those are accidents. What terrorists do is on purpose. It's cold-blooded murder. But, writes Blum, if the American military sends out a bombing mission on a Monday, which kills multiple innocent civilians, and then the military announces, sorry, that was an accident, and then on Tuesday the American military sends out a bombing mission, which kills multiple innocent civilians, and then the military announces, sorry, that was an accident, and then on Wednesday, the American military sends out a bombing mission, which kills multiple innocent civilians, and the military then announces, sorry, that was an accident, Thursday, Friday, how long before the American military loses the right to say it was an accident, end quote. That was Bill Blum in his latest anti-empire report. And if attacks by American forces using drones or helicopters or fighter planes don't kill civilians on a daily basis, as he wrote to illustrate the problem, They have done so enough times to let the peoples of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen, Somalia, know that Americans are indifferent to the lives and blood of innocent civilians, that our forces continue to spill thousands of miles from our shores in an ongoing war against people who have not attacked us. Every so often, following a fatal airstrike in his country, Afghan President Hamid Karzai loudly complains to the world that Washington must cease launching airstrikes that kill innocent civilians. One can conclude from recent reports in the New York Times that the CIA has been delivering sacks of money running into the millions to Karzai since he took office. His public complaints about civilian casualties are simply his way of letting the CIA know that he's in need of another shipment of cold, hard cash, courtesy of the American taxpayers. On May 5th, the Times reported the CIA station chief here met with President Karzai on Saturday. And the Afghan leader said he had been assured the agency would continue dropping off stacks of cash at his office despite a storm of criticism that has erupted since the payments were disclosed. The CIA money, Mr. Karzai told reporters, was, quote, an easy source of petty cash, end quote, and some of it was used to pay off members of the political elite, a group dominated by warlords.